I'll turn that down just a little bit. Okay, good morning. Welcome everybody to Bio 231. It's May 7th. May 7th. Okay, really fast. So we got two more weeks of school left, and so we had a test last time. In lecture, all your grades are in Blackboard. You'll see your tests during lab this week. If not, see me during office hours tomorrow. Today we're going to have a lecture on respiratory system. And no lecture exams this week or lab practicums, but next week is your fifth and last lab practicum. That's the last week of school. There will not be a lab that day, but there'll be a lab practicum and either one or two quizzes, depending on what lab you're in. The Monday group will get two quizzes. The Wednesday group will just get one quiz, the regular quiz number 10. The Monday group gets that extra quiz that you can use as a replacement for a dropped quiz. The Wednesday group already took the extra quiz earlier on in the semester. All right, so that's the deal. And a week from today, I won't be here, and I'll try really hard to get a guest lecturer in for you, because next Monday, we're supposed to talk about urinary system. Okay, and I'll try to get a guest lecturer in for that, and then also somebody else to proctor the practicum and lab quizzes for you on Monday. But I'll be back on Wednesday. All right, so I'll be off campus Monday and Tuesday of next week. I'll be over at the district office in Anaheim, so I can't be here unless somebody figures out how to be in two places at one time, but that's really difficult to do that. I've never been able to figure out how to do that. Okay, so today, respiratory system. Here is respiratory system. Now, how do I usually arrange this? Do I put the text slide over here?
No.
I keep it here? Oh, and then I just flip to things right there. Okay, I can do that. Okay, so respiratory system. The functions of the respiratory system is ventilation. Ventilation is just the mechanics of moving air in and out of the lungs. We'll look and see how that happens. Gas exchange, which is air that's in the lungs, how that exchanges with the blood. That happens, of course, in the lungs. And then transport of oxygen and CO2 in your body. That's an important part of the respiratory system. And then gas exchange on the other end, where you have capillaries in the systemic spaces of your body. So gas exchange in the lungs, those are pulmonary capillaries. And then gas exchange between blood and tissues, those are with systemic capillaries. All right, let's look at some of the anatomy of the respiratory tract. And some books and some people have this broken down a little bit differently, but what I like is that the upper respiratory tract starts with the nose, right? The nasal cavity includes the pharynx. And remember, the pharynx is just another name for throat, and it's an elongated structure, so part of the pharynx is posterior to the nasal cavity. That's what we're going to call the nasopharynx. And then posterior to the oral cavity, that's the oral pharynx. And then posterior to the pharynx right here is the laryngopharynx. And so that's all part of the upper airway, even though it's also commonly used for swallowing food and drink and things like that. All right, the lower respiratory tract, in most books that I'm familiar with, starts with the larynx. And the larynx has all of these blue cartilages in them. And the most superior part is the epiglottis, and has some other cartilages that we're going to talk about. Other books, and maybe even your book, but I haven't found it in your book, includes the larynx in the upper respiratory tract. And the lower respiratory tract then starts with the trachea, which is this airway right here. All right, so just be aware that different people might talk about it in different ways. But I like the lower respiratory tract starting with the larynx, not the trachea. All right, so let's take a look. Let's continue on by looking at all of these different structures right here. So then the trachea is distal or inferior to the larynx, and it's held open all the time by tracheal cartilaginous rings. These don't completely encircle the trachea. They're open in the back, so we call them C-shaped. And then the trachea bifurcates down here at the carina into the main bronchus. So here's a left main bronchus, right main bronchus. All right, and then that brings air into either the right or left lung. And then a main bronchus is going to bifurcate, that I see right here, into secondary bronchi. They're smaller. And then the secondary bronchus is going to bifurcate once again into even smaller airways that are held open. This would be a tertiary bronchus, right? And then smaller and smaller and smaller. Finally, you get down to some microscopic airways that don't have cartilage in them, and we call those bronchioles. So bronchiole, typically, or by definition, does not have cartilage to hold that tube open, but it has smooth muscle instead, which can cause constriction and will restrict airflow to that part of the lung. Okay, I notice that the left lung is bigger than the right lung. Right lung. Okay, because of the heart. It's mostly on the left side of the body, and it puts a little notch, which we call the cardiac notch, in the left lung over here. Okay, and of course, both lungs are above the diaphragm, which is the most important muscle for breathing and in particular inspiration. So we see the right lung has three lobes and the left lung only has two lobes. It's a little bit smaller. All right, so let's find a good picture of the larynx. Here's a pretty good picture of the larynx right here. So tucked inside your mandible is your hyoid bone. That's not part of the larynx. All right, but this blue structure is, that's the epiglottis. That's the trapdoor. We talked about that in lab. When you swallow something, the epiglottis flops down over the opening to the larynx. What do we call the opening to the larynx? Starts with a G. That is a glottis. That's right, because when you swallow something, you don't want it to go down here into the trachea or bronchus. That would be what we call choking, right? And that could be fatal. So the epiglottis flops down over the glottis, prevents food from entering the larynx, and then therefore it goes down into the esophagus. All right, we have some other cartilages of the larynx that hold the vocal cord, so they got to be pretty stiff structures for vocalization. The most prominent of these is the thyroid cartilage, and in guys is very prominent, right? That's the most superior and anterior point right here. Just below it, normally you would find the thyroid glands in this location, not shown on this particular diagram. The thyroid cartilage, even though it's very prominent anteriorly, doesn't completely go around. It's C-shaped as well. We find it only on the anterior side of the larynx, unlike the cricoid cartilage right here, which can be found posteriorly. And you'll notice if we look at a sagittal view that it is the largest cartilage in the larynx because of its prominence posteriorly. And it completely does encircle or girdle, for instance, you could use the term girdle, the larynx. All right, so here is a nice sagittal section. We can see the epiglottis right here. Remember, it flops down over the glottis when we swallow, protecting the larynx from invasion of food particles and water. So here is the thyroid cartilage. We see it only anteriorly, but here is the cricoid cartilage that completely encircles that distal segment of the larynx. Here are the ligaments for vocalization. Here is a true vocal cord or a vocal fold, and the tension on this vocal cord can be adjusted by the articulation of the arytenoid cartilage. There's a pivot joint, and there are muscles that can pivot the arytenoid, which then puts more or less tension on this vocal cord right here. And as the tension is increased, what happens to the frequency of vibration of this vocal cord when the tension is increased? The frequency goes up, right? And so the pitch of somebody's voice just gets higher and higher and higher and higher, and then I can't make it any tighter than that, okay? And my voice doesn't go much higher than that. This right here is what we call a vestibular fold. It's a false vocal cord. It's just some fleshy part of the larynx above or superior to the true vocal cord right here. Okay, so that doesn't vibrate, okay? But it does get inflamed when the vocal cords get inflamed. And what do we call an inflammation of the larynx? Yeah, it's laryngitis, and that's when you can't speak, right? Because these things are just too stiff and inflamed to vibrate. As opposed to an inflammation of this posterior structure to the larynx, which is the pharynx, what do we call that? That's a pharyngitis, or commonly you would call that a sore throat. So there's a difference between the structures of a laryngitis and a sore throat. All right, the other thing in your list, I don't know, you might have the corniculate cartilage, which is a small cartilage, which is just right on top of the arytenoids. All right, both of those are for controlling the pitch of the voice. And remember, the glottis is not a structure, it's a hole in the larynx, right? just like the pupil is not really a structure, it's a hole in what? The pupil is a hole in the, it's a hole in the iris, right? So it allows light to enter the eye. The glottis allows air to enter the larynx. All right, then, distal to the larynx, we have the trachea, right? It's anterior to the esophagus. Let's see if I can find a nice picture of that. Oh, I guess this is a good picture right here. I want to go back to the previous slide in just a little bit. So here is the esophagus, right, which is posterior to the trachea. Here's the trachea anterior to the esophagus. The trachea is held open by C-shaped cartilaginous rings. And the lining of the trachea is pretty special, right? There's an epithelium, right, that covers this surface. And that epithelium is a ciliated columnar epithelium. Actually, it's what, a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium, like I see right here. So I see some nice hyaline cartilage. This is a typical section of the trachea. Hyaline cartilage from the C-shaped rings, right? And then a submucosa, right, which is the basement membrane for the epithelium, and here is the epithelium, here are the nice cilia, and here's that pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium along with some, oh, what does this look like right here? That's a nice goblet cell that's secreting mucus, and I can see a layer of mucus right here. So these cilia are sweeping all the time because this mucus attracts bacteria and viruses and other kinds of microscopic debris like dust particles. And which way do you think they're sweeping? Do you think they're sweeping? Where was that nice picture at? Are they sweeping so all this mucus and dust goes down into the lungs, or are they sweeping in an upward direction so that it removes the material from your lungs? Right, so they're all sweeping in a superior direction. So you'll have a bolus of mucus loaded with dust particles up here in your pharynx. And when it's in your pharynx, then what do you do with that bolus of debris and mucus? Okay? Usually, you just swallow it down, okay, and get rid of it out of your body. Unless you're a baseball player, and then what do you have the luxury of doing? Then you spit it out and spit it out and spit it out and spit it out. You're spitting constantly, okay? But normal people don't do that. You just swallow it down. Okay. So what else do I see on this slide? Good exam figure right here, also a quiz figure in lab. I see some paranasal sinuses and some bones that you should be familiar with, like the sagittal paranasal sinus, the frontal paranasal sinus. Here is part of the ethmoid bone. We can't see any paranasal sinuses on the ethmoid bone in this illustration, but indeed the ethmoid bone does have paranasal sinuses, but I can see the cribriform plate with olfactory foramina within the ethmoid bone, and that allows the projection of olfactory nerves into the nasal cavity for the sense of, what sense is that? Olfaction, yeah, it's the olfactory sense. And then we see some of the air conditioning plates within the nasal cavity. These are the nasal conchae, the superior and middle part of the ethmoid bone. The inferior one is a bone all by itself. All right, so when the air is cold compared to your body temperature, these plates right here warm it up. And when the air is hot compared to your body temperature, these plates cool it down so that you don't burn or freeze your lungs. Or if the air is very dry, these plates also humidify the air so you don't turn your lungs into potato chips, right? Because then they can't expand and contract normally. So these condition the air. Okay, here's the opening for the auditory tube. What's another name for auditory tube? Yeah, pharyngotympanic tube. What's another name? Eustachian tube. And where does that, where does the other end of the eustachian tube go? So I see it here in the pharynx. It goes to your ear, and you should know what part of the ear, and that is the middle ear that equalizes pressure across the tympanic membrane so that the tympanic membrane can vibrate back and forth. Right? And that's necessary in order for you to do what? Hear something. Right? So that's the sense of hearing. So this is right here in your nasal cavity, important structure for the sense of hearing, surprisingly. All right, then you have the hard palate made of the maxilla and the palatine bones. And then here's the soft palate made of this little muscle and some soft tissue and a tonsil. This is a palatine tonsil. And the very tip right smack in the middle, that's the uvula. That helps you in swallowing, because when you swallow something, This muscle pulls the uvula back up against the nasal pharynx so that food can't end up in your nasal cavity. Right? That's really a mess when it ends up in the nasal cavity. And some people, when they have a cleft palate or a malformation of the hard palate right here, when they chew something or eat or swallow, food does go up into the nasal cavity, which I suppose is a problem, but it's more of a problem because then it doesn't go down the esophagus. And if you're an infant that's nursing and food is going up into the nasal cavity, exiting the nose, not going down the esophagus, what's going to happen to you? Well, then you're going to perish, right? Because you're not getting nutrition. So a cleft palate is very problematic, especially for newborns. Okay, so I see the nasal pharynx, the oral pharynx, the laryngeal pharynx, and the larynx, and then the trachea down over here. These tonsils, okay, somebody did mention irony last time or in time before, because the tonsils are there. They're part of the lymphatic system. They fight infection, but they are prone to becoming chronically infected themselves, right? And if that's the case, then they have to be removed. Commonly, the palatines are removed. Adenoids or the pharyngeal tonsil would be number two. I've never heard of this lingual tonsil being removed, but I'm just not that familiar with it. All right, so these fight infection of infectious agents that are trying to get into your body through what? Your nasal cavity or oral cavity right here. Okay, so the other thing I notice on this slide, here's a nice thyroid gland. Okay, so let's look at the word slide over here. The cartilaginous rings in the trachea or windpipe, what is their function? Yeah, to keep the larynx open and also to make a nice hard structure so these vocal cords can vibrate on something. But even the tracheal cartilages right here don't have vocal cords, but they hold the trachea open all the time. Because sometimes to exhale, when we're exercising, we have to compress our chest and even squeeze our lungs up into the thoracic cavity by compressing our abdominal muscles. So the pressure inside our thorax or thoracic cavity increases quite a bit, the force that air out. And when that pressure increases, it would compress the trachea. It would cause an occlusion of the trachea. And when the trachea occludes, then air, of course, can't leave the lungs, so you would not be able to exhale. But why is exhalation important? A couple of reasons I could think of why exhalation is important. Why do you exhale? Okay, number one reason is because in order to inhale again to get oxygen in your body, there's got to be some space, right? And if your lungs are filled with air, you can't inhale anymore. So exhalation is important because that allows for inspiration. And the other thing is when you exhale air, you're exhalating waste products, namely carbon dioxide, maybe in some other kinds of compounds as well. Okay. So exhalation is important for getting rid of CO2. Okay, a bronchus. We saw a bronchus, right? When the trachea goes down, bifurcates into a bronchus. The primary is to the right or left lung, and then it's going to bifurcate into secondary, right, and then into tertiary bronchi, depending on what part of the lungs it's going to. All right, the lungs themselves have different zones. The conducting zone are the parts of the airways inside the lung where no gas exchange takes place. So these are macroscopic structures. Okay, so I guess I can see a bronchiole right here. Gas exchange does not happen here. It's not surrounded by capillaries. Secondary bronchi. Right, tertiary bronchi, there's no gas exchange, and there's cartilage around these structures that keep these airways open all the time. All right, so that's part of the conducting zone. And then, all right, after the cartilage disappears, we get into a bronchiole. So here's a bronchiole, and I can see that it's smooth muscle, and there's some circular smooth muscles around there. Still, gas exchange does not take place in a terminal bronchiole, and then it bifurcates into smaller bronchioles right here that we call respiratory bronchioles because they have these little pouches on them. And this little pouch is called an alveolus, right? Alveolus just describes the structure of the structure, which is what? Spherical. And so this is a respiratory bronchiole because it's not loaded with alveoli, but there's a couple of them here and there. This allows for gas exchange. So that's what we call the respiratory zone. That's what we call the respiratory zone in the lungs. Okay, and then the respiratory bronchioles are going to branch into alveolar ducts. That's part of the respiratory zone because it has alveoli. And then finally, the alveolar duct is going to terminate in a group of alveoli that looks like a bunch of grapes just growing on the vine. So these are what we call alveoli. We put a bunch of alveoli together, we get an alveolar sac. And since gas exchange takes place here, it's part of the respiratory zone as well. Okay, let's take a look at maybe a nice cross-section of an alveolar sac. So here are all of the alveoli. There are pores between alveoli, so air can flow from one to the other. And I can see them on the illustration as well. Okay, here is a respiratory bronchiole that has alveoli on them. And I can see a capillary blood vessel right here. This is for gas exchange. All right, the other thing I notice on this alveolus right here, so alveolus is singular, alveoli is plural, there's going to be a network of capillaries that surround every alveolus. That's for gas exchange. But there's going to be something else surrounding an alveolus, and it's going to be elastic fibers, not collagen fibers, because they don't stretch, not reticular fibers because they'd be too easily damaged, but elastic fibers. And what's the really cool thing about elastic fibers? They're designed to stretch without damage. And then when the tension is released, what happens to them? They go back to their original length, right? So normally the lung is collapsed. And then when you inhale, these elastic fibers stretch. And then when you exhale, what happens? Those elastic fibers then collapses the alveolus, and that allows you to exhale air. All right, let's talk a little bit more about the structure of this alveolus right here. Oh, here's even a better picture. Here you can see the elastic fibers, and here you can see like the proximal end of a capillary and the distal end completely surrounding this alveolus. So this shows a nice relationship between a terminal bronchiole, respiratory bronchiole, the alveolar sac, and then some elastic fibers around the alveolar sac as well as capillaries. So that's really a nice picture. I wish my physiology book had a picture like that, but I suppose I could steal it from this book. All right, so here is a nice illustration of one alveolus. And the alveolus is made out of an epithelium. How would you classify this epithelium right here? First, by number of layers. How many layers do you see? Simple. What's the shape of these cells? Squamous. Yeah, so it's a simple squamous epithelium that makes the wall of the alveolus. And remember, a simple squamous epithelium is specialized for exchange because molecules can diffuse across that epithelium very easily because it is so thin. And then surrounding every capillary, here is a blood vessel, and there's an endothelium, which is the inner wall of the capillary. And what do these cells look like right here? What kind of epithelium? Oh, here it is right here, even a better view. What kind of epithelium is a wall of a capillary? How many layers thick do you see? Just one, so it's simple. And what's the shape of the cell? It's simple, it's squamous as well. So the lining of a capillary is a simple squamous epithelium. Simple squamous epithelium in a capillary, simple squamous epithelium on the wall of the alveolus, that is specialized for exchange of gases like oxygen entering the capillary and CO2 leaving. Okay. The other things that I notice in this alveolus right here, I see some other kinds of cells, right? I can see some pores right here. And I can see some of these that look blue to me, but they might look purple to you. I'm not really sure. Okay, blue, purple, okay, I know. It's hard to tell. So these are what we call macrophages. Macrophages come from the circulatory system. They were monocytes at one time, and they crawl through the spaces, and they're looking for dust and bacteria and viruses. right? And a macrophage will then engulf that infectious particle by phagocytosis, and then lyse that particular material, right? I mean, break those cells down so that they can't cause an infection in the lungs. And then they actually crawl back into the capillary right here, and then they crawl back out of the capillary in a thymus gland or other kind of lymphatic tissue, and it brings that digested bacteria to a lymphatic organ so that it can learn how to recognize that bacteria and then develop immunity against it, either making a contact killer cell or antibodies. Okay, some bacteria have figured out a way to defeat the purpose of this macrophage, like anthrax, for instance. This macrophage can grab an anthrax bacteria, grab it deep inside the body, take it to a thymus gland, okay, but it doesn't kill the anthrax bacteria, so then the bacteria then has easy access to your body and can figure out a way to defeat your immune system. That's why anthrax is such an infectious bacteria. Tuberculosis. I'm not so familiar with the pathology of tuberculosis. I don't know what kind of bacteria it is, okay, or even what kind of infectious particle it is. Okay, but again, that's another very infectious disease process. Again, it seems to have defeated the properties of these macrophages right here. Okay, we have two types of cells that make up the wall of the alveolus. There is a type 1 cell that I see right here, and then there's a type 2 cell that has a little bit of a ruffled edge to it. And this cell secretes a compound, an inner lining of the alveolus right here. All right, and that inner lining, so here's the lining of the alveolus, is going to have some of that chemical from a type 2 cell that we call a surface active agent, or sometimes for short we call it surfactant. All right, so we have a layer of surfactant right here, the wall of the alveolus. We have a very thin basement membrane or interstitial space right through here, and then the wall of the capillary. That describes the membrane that this oxygen and CO2 has to diffuse across. And we call that the respiratory membrane. Okay, so respiratory membrane has got four parts. I don't know if I have it. Do I have it listed? Oh, gosh, I don't have it listed in your notes. Maybe it's someplace. Oh, yeah, respiratory membrane for gas exchange. First, the layer of surfactant, then the wall of the alveolus, the interstitial space, and then the wall of the capillary. All right, so make sure you know this list. Your book kind of shortchanges that layer of surfactant right here, but that's a hugely important layer that I don't want you to forget about. Right? It's not cellular. It's not like these epithelia right here, but it plays a very important role. The type 2 cell secretes surfactant into the alveolus for the following reason. What can you tell me about water? Is it slippery or is it sticky? I hear both. Okay, why can't I turn the lights on? What do I gotta do? Play, I don't know. Okay. Hooray. Okay, so some people said slippery, and indeed, if there was a puddle of water on the floor right outside the door and you stepped on it, you might slide, right? You might slip, boom, and fall on your, what did Forrest Gump used to say? Buttocks, okay? But I want you to realize that water, because of its chemical properties, is actually very sticky. It's a sticky substance. And that has played some important roles in breathing, and it causes some problems. So here I have a couple acetates right here. Okay, I'm going to put them together, and I have a willing demonstrator right here. Okay, I'm going to hold one of the transparencies, and you're going to grab the bottom one, okay? And notice that they're just dry transparencies, and then I'm going to let go, and can we separate them? Really easy, because there's no glue holding them together. But let's just say we want to glue these things together. What could we use as glue because it's sticky?
Water.
Yeah, water, as a matter of fact. And maybe we have some water right here. Oh, we do have some water. Fantastic. Okay. So then, we're going to put these two transparencies together, like this, okay, and now, have they been glued together? Okay. Because water molecules are very sticky. They stick to the transparency, they stick to each other, and stick to the other transparency. So now, if we're going to try and separate these two transparencies again, I'm holding both of them, okay? And if I let go, you can see they're still stuck together. And if you grab the bottom one again, notice how hard that is. Aha! I can lift you right up out of your chair. Because water molecules are very sticky. So, in terms of breathing, that's problematic because there's water on the inside of these alveoli, which would mean what? That this wall over here, right, would stick to this wall over here, and then it would never inflate because of the properties of water. So there's a compound called surfactant that these type 2 cells secrete. It's like a detergent or a soap. And, of course, soap, as you realize, is even slipperier than water. That decreases the surface tension, which is what we just demonstrated right here, and allows this alveoli to inflate. All right, these cells, the type 2 cells, really get activated through the process of, through a very stressful process in a neonate, and that stressful process is parturition, right? So if you go through a normal birth process, which is very stressful on the infant, then these cells start secreting surfactant, so as soon as you're born, with a little tap on the buttocks once again, right? That little infant will start crying and breathing and these alveoli will inflate and then you have nice pulmonary function. But for a premature, right, a preterm infant, these, and especially born by cesarean section, these type 2 cells are not mature and they don't secrete surfactant, so that's one of the first considerations you have to give a newborn baby, especially premature, can they actually inflate these alveoli so that they can start to breathe on their own? And if they can't, then what do we do for them? Then they have to be put in a high oxygen concentration, right, to overcome this deficit, which is what we call an incubator, plus other kinds of problems, like temperature regulation is difficult as well. All right, so that is surfactant. Don't forget about surfactant. Okay. All right, pleural cavities. Let's look at some cavities inside the lungs. Don't know if I have a nice picture. Where's a nice picture of some cavities? All right, but the pleural membrane is a serous membrane. Maybe, okay, that's not bad, but here it is over here. Okay, so here is a nice transverse section we see going through the torso. So I see part of the mediastinum with the heart in it, and then I see the pleural cavities with the lungs in it right here. And remember, there are two major kinds of membranes in your body. What are the names of the two major membranes? Mucous membrane and serous membrane. Okay, so a membrane is something that lines a cavity. And a mucous membrane lines a cavity that's open to the outside world. And so give me an example of a mucous membrane. Yeah, you know, nasal cavity, oral cavity, urinary tract, open to the outside world. Digestive tract, open to the outside world. Reproductive tract, open to the outside world. That has a mucous membrane lining. But there are some cavities that are not open to the outside world for good reason, like the membrane system around the heart. And even around the lungs on its exterior surface right here is not open to the outside world. So this membrane is what we call a serous membrane. The pericardium is a serous membrane. The pleural membrane is a serous membrane because it's not open to the outside world. And I think you remember that a serous membrane has three parts to it, right? There's a parietal division, a visceral division, and there's a cavity, a serous cavity, between them. Maybe I'll turn the lights off. Is that easier? Better? Who knows? Okay. So, here is the lung proper. Oh, and just for fun, what is this blue blood vessel right here? Pulmonary artery. And the red blood vessel is the pulmonary vein. Remember, pulmonary circulation is opposite compared to systemic in terms of oxygen concentration. All right, so let's get back to the topic at hand. So here is the lung. Here is the membrane that's right on the surface of the lung. It's part of the serous membrane, and this is the visceral division that's touching the organ. Okay, and then if we trace it around all the way over here, we see that it is continuous with the membrane that's not touching the lungs, but is now touching the wall of the thorax. This is what we call the parietal division of the pleural membrane. They're continuous. And over here I can see that they're continuous once again. But since they're in two locations, they got to have two different names. And then here is the serous cavity or pleural cavity with pleural fluid in there or serous fluid. Now this fluid right here does not have surfactant in it. So what can you tell me about the surface of the lung and the surface of the wall of the thorax, since it has water in there? Yeah, they're glued together. The surface of the lung is glued to the wall of the thorax. So during breathing, when you expand your thorax, it actually pulls the lungs open so that you can inhale. That's one of the reasons why air moves into your lungs, because the serous fluid is sticky. It's more of a watery solution. Okay. But water does act like a little bit of a lubricant so that the lung can slide around on the inside of the thoracic wall. But mostly that water in here couples the wall of the thorax to the lungs for inflation. All right, so that is the serous membrane of the lungs, or the pleural membrane. What about some of the mechanics of breathing? Right, inspiration is due to the enlargement of the thoracic cavity. And there are two kinds of breathing. There's something called quiet breathing, and there's something called forced breathing. And what you all are doing right now is quiet breathing. You're just not exercising, but if all of a sudden we all got up and in a circle ran around the room, like a practicum, but we all run around the room 10 times, we would no longer be breathing quietly. We would be breathing in a forced fashion, right? We'd be hyperventilating due to that exercise. So there are different mechanisms that play a role in these two kinds of breathing. Okay, so for quiet breathing, like you're doing right now, mostly it's due to the diaphragm when it contracts. So here is the diaphragm right here. When it's relaxed, it's in a dome shape. When it contracts, it gets pulled inferiorly. It moves all the way down to here. Thereby, it increases the size of the thoracic cavity by this volume that I am circling with the cursor. So the volume of the thoracic cavity increases when the diaphragm contracts. All right, let me see if there's a nice slide on this. I think I saw something over here. Okay, so I see the diaphragm right here. That doesn't show it very well. Here it is. Okay. So here the diaphragm is dome-shaped. So does this mean the diaphragm is contracted or relaxed? It's relaxed. All right, so here is the volume of the thoracic cage when the diaphragm relaxed, which is relatively small. Then when the diaphragm contracts, it moves all the way down to this position. What happens to the volume of the lungs right here? It gets bigger. Okay, so there's a relationship between pressure and volume, which is this relationship right here. All right, so pressure is going to be equal to 1 over the volume. So let's just start with this equation right here. How about if we say pressure is going to be equal to something, some variable. Okay, something. So if something increases, what happens to pressure? If something increases, what happens to pressure? Okay, it increases. We say there's a direct relationship. Pressure is directly related to something. If something increases, so does pressure. Okay, so this is a direct relationship. But when you look at something like this, that's not a direct relationship. Because when volume increases, what happens to pressure? okay, it goes the opposite way because volume is in the denominator. This is what we call an inverse relationship. Over here is direct, and over here is inverse. So when something has an inverse relationship to each other, if one parameter increases, the other decreases. Okay. So on inspiration, we see the diaphragm contracting, right, which means that the volume is increasing. So this is the equation that we want to pay attention to right here. Right, when the diaphragm contracts, the volume increases, but what happens to pressure inside the thorax when the volume increases? Okay, it decreases because of that inverse relationship. All right, now how does a fluid move? Air will flow, or a liquid will flow from one area to another based on a pressure difference. It will flow from high pressure to low pressure. Okay, so when the diaphragm contracts, the volume of the thorax gets big, the pressure decreases inside the lungs, the pressure in the air stays the same, the pressure in the air is high compared to your lungs. Which way is air going to flow? From the air into your lungs, because the pressure in your lungs is low, because the volume got big. All right, so we can demonstrate that with this little model right here. So this represents your thorax. This black rubber thing is the diaphragm. Uh-oh. I broke it. Okay, maybe I can fix it. Okay, maybe not. I bet I can. All right, and this little wood knob doesn't represent anything in particular. Uh-oh, now I really did break it. Okay, well, so here we have the esophageal hiatus, which is open right now, and I'm going to plug that with my finger. Okay, so when the diaphragm is relaxed, it's dome-shaped, right? So it's poking up into the thorax like this. It's poking in. And when it's relaxed, what about the balloons? Are they inflated?
No.
They're not. When the diaphragm contracts, it's going to be pulled inferiorly like this, increasing the volume of the thoracic cage, decreasing the pressure inside the jar. And what happens to the lungs then? Air flows in. Okay? And then when the diaphragm relaxes, air flows out. When the diaphragm contracts, okay, they inflate all day long just like that. Okay, but so that's under quiet breathing conditions. Wow, they're never going to give that model back to me again. Okay, so quiet breathing, okay, inspiration is due to contraction of the diaphragm. Relaxation, right, or exhalation for quiet breathing, there are no muscles that are necessary because every muscle has elastic properties, right? So when the diaphragm contracts to this position right here, when it relaxes because of elastic properties of the diaphragm, it automatically goes back to this shape right here, causing the volume of the thorax to decrease. When the volume of the thorax decreases, what happens to pressure inside the thorax? It goes up, it goes above atmospheric pressure, so that forces air out of the lungs. All right, but there's another, even more important factor that forces the air out of the lungs. Remember that alveolus? Okay, and remember, the alveolus has capillaries around it, but it had other special kinds of proteins. What were those other special proteins around every single alveolus? Yeah, they were the elastic proteins, right? So, here I have two different models. They're going to model an alveolus. I have this paper bag, okay, that I got yesterday, and then I have this balloon right here, which is elastic. Right, so which one is a better model of an alveolus? So I'll fill them up. So the diaphragm's going to contract. They're going to fill up with air. Why are you guys all laughing? Oh, because yesterday was Cinco de Mayo. Ah, I see. Okay, so here, not really. It was Saturday. Okay, so here's an alveolus, and it's going to fill up with air. Okay, so I have all this air trapped in here. Now, is this a good model of an alveolus? I'm just going to let go. And what's going to happen to all this air that's in this bag? Okay, so I let go. And look at that. It just stayed right there. That's going to be a very unhappy person, right? Because they can't exhale. Are there any elastic tissues in that paper bag? None whatsoever. What about this balloon right here? Okay, good. It didn't blow up in my face. Oops, sorry. Okay, so here is an alveolus with elastic properties, right? And if I let go, what's going to happen to this one? Is it going to exhale air? Oops, sorry. Okay, so I'm just going to let go. And watch out. I don't know where it went. So the air just got expelled from that alveolus because of what? The elastic properties of the balloon. Okay, people that have degeneration of those elastic fibers around an alveolus can't breathe, right, without a respirator. So thank goodness all of us have still nice elastic properties in the lungs. Okay, other kind of breathing, forced breathing, contraction of the pectoralis minor is necessary, external intercostals, maybe even the sternocleidomastoid and serratus anterior elevate the ribs. All right, so all those muscles additionally can elevate the ribs, both laterally, all right, but anteriorly as well, so your rib cage expands superiorly when the diaphragm expands the thoracic cage inferiorly. All right, so you can move a lot more air out of your lungs by contracting these muscles. And then for forced breathing, contraction of the intercostals, the internal intercostals, and all of the abdominal muscles force abdominal contents up into the thoracic cavity, which then decreases the volume some more and forces air out of the lungs. All right, so that's kind of interesting. Quiet breathing is totally different compared to forced breathing. Quiet breathing, exhalation is completely passive, like we saw. But for hyperventilation or forced breathing, then you need to use some muscles for both inspiration and expiration. So what's the hard one to remember? For inspiration, it is the external intercostals. And for expiration, it is the internal intercostals. Just because of the fascicle arrangement between the ribs, right? Some will pull the ribs up, some muscles will pull, fascicles will pull the ribs down. All right, what about some other important considerations right here? How many alveoli do we have in our lungs? All right, there's about 300 million. Can't see them without a microscope. And they have that shape because it allows for exchange between air in the alveolus and a capillary. And whenever you think of, there's a way to measure that area for exchange, and we call it a surface area. The bigger the surface area, the easier it is for compounds to move across that membrane, through the respiratory membrane. So, what do we have right here? I've got a piece of paper. What's the surface area of this piece of paper? It's 8.5 inches by 11. I don't know, somebody get your cell phone out. Multiply 8.5 by 11, right? That's going to be the surface area of this piece of paper. Right, I'm going to write it down because I should know what it is. I can't remember what it is. 8.5 by 11 in square inches. Okay. 93.5. Okay, square inches, all right. And then let's look at this doorway over here. Is it obvious which one is bigger, the piece of paper or the doorway? How would we measure the surface area of this doorway right here? I got a ruler. Okay, let's do it. We got to measure the width times the height. Okay, just like we did on that piece of paper, width times the height. So let's see, what's the width of this door? Oh, look at that, fantastic. Exactly 1 meter. So that's going to be easy to multiply by. And then what's the height? The height of this door is 1 meter. Okay, and oh, look, exactly 2 meters. That's really handy. All right, so what's the surface area of this doorway? It's 1 times 2, or 2 square meters. And we could convert from inches to meters if we wanted to. Not so important. But, okay, what do I want you to remember about a surface area? The common word for surface area in exchange is a, what is this thing right here? It's a doorway for entering or leaving a room, or entering or leaving a compartment of your body. And let's just think about people as exchanging through that doorway. How many people could get through this small doorway right here? One time. Maybe not even one, because the doorway is too small. What about that doorway over there that's 2 square meters? Maybe 2 or 3 people. Or what about if we have a garage door that you can drive a car through? How many people can get through a garage door at one time? 20, 50, I don't know, depending on how hard you tried, right? So as the doorway, as the surface area increases, what can you tell me about exchange? It increases. It's directly related, right? It's directly related. So the bigger the doorway, more exchange can take place. All right, so think of surface area as a doorway for exchange. All right, so what is the doorway for exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the lungs? Somebody actually took an alveolus and peeled every single alveolus like you peel an orange and put it down on a flat table like this, okay, and then measured what that surface area would be. Take every 300 million alveoli, lay it out flat like that, and then measure the surface area, and it turns out to be 70 square meters. What was the surface area of that door right there? That was 2 square meters, right? So that's what? That's 35 times, right? That doorway, right? That's a huge surface area. But in real life, what that would be comparable to would be half of the surface area of half of a tennis court. That's 70 square meters. So through evolution, okay, those processes have figured out a way to take that huge surface area and fold it up and stick it inside your body, and that's really marvelous, because I can't imagine why I would like to be as wide as a tennis court and half as tall as a tennis court, right, just so that I could breathe, just for exchange. All right, so when we say surface area, what concept should you just automatically replace that with? Doorway, yeah, surface area and doorway for exchange, and they're directly related to each other. Okay. What are some last topics that we want to talk about? Control of respiration. Right, control of respiration occurs in the respiratory center, which is in the medulla. And it controls both the rate and depth of respiration. There are some nuclei that are in the medulla. There's the ventral respiratory group and the dorsal respiratory group and the pontine respiratory center, right, that interact to allow you to breathe in a rhythmic fashion. So the ventral respiratory group is the pacemaker. So even when you're sleeping, okay, this group right here will stimulate inhalation even though the diaphragm is a skeletal muscle. So it can contract on its own because in the medulla there's a pacemaker. Where else did you run into a pacemaker? In the heart. The heart has a pacemaker that spontaneously depolarizes, that causes the heart to beat. So this VRG is the pacemaker for breathing in the medulla. All right, now if a brain has a stroke and this area right here gets destroyed, guess what happens? The normal rhythmicity of breathing is damaged and a person can't then breathe when they're sleeping. So they have to be on a respirator, for instance, when they're sleeping. So every breath they take is a voluntary action, like contracting a biceps muscle or something. Anybody know the name of that disease? Process. It's called Odin's curse, when you can't breathe automatically anymore. So you can't sleep without being on a respirator. Okay, but let's look at the outputs of the medulla. Okay, it's via the phrenic nerve. I think you saw that in lab. And the origins of the phrenic nerve are C3, 4, and 5. What's that cute little saying that you can help remember that? Remember, it comes from the phrenic nerve comes from the cervical plexus. And the divisions of the cervical plexus are 3, 4, and 5. And the little saying is 3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive, because without that phrenic nerve, then you don't have nerve impulses going to the diaphragm, conscious or unconscious, either one. No impulses can get to the diaphragm, and it won't contract. Okay, so that's a pretty important nerve. Inputs to the respiratory center. Well, we have chemoreceptors. Right, and chemoreceptors, right, we have central receptors in the medulla, in the respiratory center right here. They're very sensitive to small changes in carbon dioxide. And when carbon dioxide builds up in your body, it becomes very acidic. So there are pH monitors in the brain as well. So when we say central receptors, we mean central nervous system, whenever we say central. Okay, located in the medulla and pons. So with very small changes in CO2, which then produce very small changes in pH, making it a little bit more acidic, that's a very powerful stimulus for ventilation. So normally, how do you get rid of CO2 from your body? By exhaling, okay? We could all hold our breaths for about 20 seconds, and we wouldn't be excreting any CO2. It would build up in our bodies, and after holding your breath for 20 seconds, guess what would happen to you? What would you feel like? Oh, you'd feel very anxious because you're not breathing. You'd have a tremendous urgency to start breathing, right? Which illustrates this little diagram right here. As CO2 builds up in your body, even a little bit of buildup, that's a very powerful stimulus for increasing ventilation due to receptors that are in the brain. And if you were to hold your breath and exercise at the same time, that would even be a more powerful stimulation for ventilation, right? Or maybe even if you're breathing and exercising, because CO2 would still build up in your body, you would start hyperventilating. Okay, then we have peripheral receptors. These are in the carotid sinus and the aortic arch. So here's the arch of the aorta. These are carotid bodies that can measure oxygen. And in the carotid sinus we looked at right here, these are not too sensitive to decreasing oxygen concentrations. But if oxygen concentration drastically decreases to the point where you probably have lost consciousness already, then that can be a very powerful stimulus for ventilation. Okay, from these oxygen sensors right here. And that's a lot. We use this apparatus to describe what we call agonal breathing. Does anybody know what agonal breathing is? You might not. It's kind of a horrific kind of concept, but it's, I think, important to know. When somebody passes away, okay, maybe they were on a ventilator for a long period of time and they weren't conscious, maybe for, I don't know, it could be a day or months or whatever, and the ventilator machine is breathing for them. They might be brain dead already, so the brain has died. Okay, but these parts of the body are still functioning right here, and maybe the medulla a little bit, but not the cerebral cortex is no longer functioning. Okay, when somebody is pronounced dead and family members agree to take them off a ventilator, okay, it might take a few minutes for that person actually to die completely, right? And their heart stops when they're taken off the ventilator. And so now the blood in the aorta gets depleted of oxygen, and it triggers these oxygen sensors, right? Which is what? It initiates a very powerful reflex for breathing. And so somebody that probably has already died or in the last stages of dying might go through that very powerful ventilation reflex that we call agonal breathing, where they actually gasp for air. But don't forget, at that period of time, right, their brain has died a long, long time ago. But it's just very freaky, because what does it look like? It looks like your loved one is struggling to stay alive, but it's just this agonal reflex, right, due to stimulation of these receptors way down here in the heart. Okay, so just be prepared for that if you ever have to go through that. Central centers, right? The cerebral cortex can control your respirations because your cerebral cortex is connected to the medulla. Like, for instance, right now, what could we all do? If we all really, really wanted to, and I bet we could do this if I just gave extra credit points. Maybe next semester I'll do this. I'll bring in a camera, okay? And I'll say, okay, for 50 extra credit points, I want the whole class to hold your breath until you pass out. And you could do that. You'll take it right now, but I don't have the camera. Okay? And guess what? You can hold your breath. You can inhibit the diaphragm, right, and defeat all these reflexes right here as long as you know that you're going to get something out of it. And you'll pass out. Okay? So the cerebral cortex can control the diaphragm, but what happens right after you pass out? And you're going to start breathing right again, right? So that's a typical trick that little kids like to play on their parents sometimes. I see a lot of people shaking your head. So, oh, you did that, huh, when you were a little kid? No. And it's nothing to worry about, because as soon as they pass out, they'll just start breathing again. All right, the hypothalamus also can control the easy for me to say, right? It's not my kid. Okay, the hypothalamus can also control respiratory rate, right? Due to emotional content. Like if I said, okay, guess what? Put your books away. We're going to take a test right now for credit. And of course, probably your respiratory rate just increased a little bit. Okay, so that's another influence of the respiratory system. Then we have proprioceptors. What kind of sense is proprioception? What are the two major kinds of sensory processes? We've got general and, oh yeah, there's a number of different classifications. We have general and special, right? Eye vision is what kind of sense? Special, because you can only do it from that one location. Gustatory, olfaction, equilibrium, they're special senses. Proprioception is a sense that you get from muscles all over your body and joints. So proprioception is what we call a general sense. And anytime any of these receptors are stimulated, that will cause you to start increasing ventilation via the respiratory center in the medulla right here. So if you were to, even sitting still, not exercising, just move your knee or your elbows like this very gently, that would give you the sensation that you should increase your ventilatory rate due to these proprioceptors in these locations. And then if you were actually to start exercising, then the skeletal muscles would put a lot of CO2 in the blood, which then would stimulate the central receptors, right, and prolong that sense of increasing ventilation. Okay, you have other receptors that can influence respiration, that is touch, pain, temperature. Like, for instance, if I walked up to you right now with a needle and jabbed you in the arm, what would happen to your respiratory rate? It would increase, right? Pain sensation does. Or even maybe not a malevolent sensation like that, but just touch, okay, will increase respiratory rate. And temperature increases respiratory rate. As you get colder, your respiratory rate increases. And as a matter of fact, if I were to take an ice cube and put it on your back right now, guess what would happen? Okay, that you go like that. That's a gasp reflex, all right? And that's an autonomic reflex. It's hard to inhibit unless you know ahead of time that it's going to happen. You see somebody coming with an ice cube and you're familiar with this reflex right here. And that can lead to drowning. All right, for instance, what temperature is you are drowning without the ice cube? Okay, what can you tell me about the ocean around here? It's cold. It's really cold. Not as cold as an ice cube, but really close to where if you were to fall into the ocean, it would be like feeling an ice cube. And a couple years ago, there was a hornblower yacht in Marina Del Rey. Anybody know a hornblower yacht, what company they're involved with? They have big ships that are almost big enough to go on the ocean. They're big enough to go on the ocean, but they're not stable enough. So they usually stay around in the harbor. Like Newport Harbor has them in Marina Del Rey, and you can rent them out to hold like a Christmas party for your business or a wedding or, you know, any Cinco de Mayo or some party like that. And they just travel around the harbor and the harbor lights come on, especially during Christmas. It's real pretty because there's all the Christmas lights and things like that. So anyway, Marina Del Rey, this hornblower yacht was out for a Christmas party. So everybody from work was all dressed up in tuxedos and evening gowns and things like that. And it caught fire in the engine compartment. And it was out in the middle of the harbor, so it couldn't get to a dock to let the people off the boat. And they didn't have enough lifeboats for everybody. So people had to jump off of the boat at night, pitch black, right, because it gets dark really early in the evenings, with their evening gowns on. And I was, when I read that account in the newspaper, I was floored that nobody drowned. Because what would you expect? Somebody in an evening dress jumping into the cold water like that, as soon as they hit the cold water, they go kaplunk, their head is underwater, what's going to happen to them? They're going to go, and now they have this lung of cold seawater, right? So that's a really easy, perfect way to die as a result of that. But then I read further and I noticed that before they shoved the people off the boat that was burning, they actually put a life preserver on them. So maybe they didn't go underwater all the way, or if they did take a lung full of air, they came back up to the surface and somebody dragged them to shore. So, I don't know. I thought that was really rude to have all these guests come over to your boat and then throw them off in the middle of the night into an harbor. Okay. But I suppose that's better if the boat was burning. Okay. And nobody died of this gasp reflex right here. All right, so that's it for respiratory system. And the sign-in sheet is going around someplace. So what do we got to do next time? Next time we're going to do digestive system. Now don't forget, what do we call a surface area for exchange?
Doorway.
Doorway. Okay, so we're going to talk about that next time.